and welcome to the HSJ Health Check podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and this week I'm joined by Matt Discombe, who covers safety and care quality, and James Ilmon, whose focus is recovery and performance. Last week, just a few days after Boris Johnson confirmed England would unlock on July the 19th, local systems were sent a rather unwelcome letter from NHS England and Improvement, telling them they would need to carry out more planned procedures to receive money from the elective recovery fund. This comes as many trusts around the country are starting to see pressures build again. We'll be discussing this in more detail, as well as news that trusts in the North East have told staff identified as close contacts with positive COVID cases they can continue to work if they take daily tests. We'll also be looking at news that many trusts will be asking the public to wear masks beyond Freedom Day, as well as keeping many other of their COVID infection control measures. But first, we're going to talk about this letter. James, you covered this for HSJ. I think the first question is really, what did this surprise letter say?
Sure. So on Friday, I'm always suspicious when news drops on Friday, because it normally means that people don't want too much coverage about it. But NHS England and Improvement informed local leaders, so ICS leaders, that they need to carry out a significantly higher amount of planned procedures to receive cash from the elective recovery fund than they'd previously been told when the scheme was outlined in March. So just a brief recap on the elective recovery fund. It's a £1 billion fund that was set up to help trusts with the backlog, the elective backlog. The waiting list now is, has been well reported, is over 5 million and is in a very dire place. So this £1 billion, the ERF as it's called, was brought in to incentivize more elective activity. So when the kind of terms of the ERF were outlined in planning guidance in March, it said that ICSs, which carry out more than 85% of their 2019 activity levels, so their pre-COVID levels by July, would be eligible for a share of the funding. The amount being handed out is still a sort of being worked out, so but you know, a slice of that £1 billion funding, and that's to fund all sorts of things, from new elective sort of initiatives to weekend shifts and activity done in the independent sector. So yeah, fast forward to Friday, and a letter drops from NHS England and Improvement to tell trusts that that figure, the 85% level, the target which they were expected to achieve, has now been increased from straight away from July to 95% of the 2019 activity levels. So
James, I mean, I'm loath to use a football metaphor at this point in the week, but why have they changed the goalposts at this point as well? And the context around this is quite important, but I'm sure we'll come on to that.
Yeah. So it's a good question. So interestingly, the letter said that they were doing this because the service had made, quotes, excellent progress in restoring elective care whilst dealing with the significant increase in demand for urgent and emergency care. So it feels like the reward for doing well has been that everything has been made a lot harder. On one level, the move seems understandable. NHS England and Improvement, as the centre, have a few different levers they can pull to try and incentivise more activity to be done. And one of the big levers that they've got is financial incentive. So, you know, by increasing these thresholds, they're using their main lever to try and get what everybody wants to happen, which is for more operations to be done and patients to be waiting, you know, no longer than they should have to. But unfortunately, that's a very overly simplistic narrative and doesn't really take into account the challenging climate that the NHS finds itself in at the moment. And the first big problem, as you alluded to in the in your opening, is that the environment at the moment for the NHS is getting increasingly harder. We're, you know, very well aware that COVID infection rates are soaring at the moment, hospitalization rates are increasing, and we're expecting all this to get worse after the 19th of July, when there's the opening, the, you know, quote unquote Freedom Day. And yeah, we're not actually that far away from winter, and then all sorts of extra pressures because of the increases in respiratory diseases will pop up as well. So, you know, things are going to get a lot harder for the NHS. And this all comes at a time when the capacity for the NHS to deal with demands is decreasing. So not only does the NHS have all the physical capacity constraints imposed on it by infection control regimes, they've got, you know, less beds, it takes longer to clean theatres and the like, so those any sort of procedures are taking far longer, donning and doffing of PPE, all of that. And more recently, the kind of most recent additional barrier is staff being forced to self-isolate because they've been pinged by the government's COVID app, which, yeah, we'll come on to discuss that a bit later. So I'll leave that for now. But it's, yeah, you've got demand increasing and capacity decreasing at the same time. And then you've got
the cherry on top.
Top of that, it's like the cherry on top is, yeah, by the way, you need to do more if you want the money. And the big problem, of course, is that all of the plans that local systems came up with when they were told the terms of the deal in March, all these plans are now in tatters. So, yeah, I mean, one ICS leader told us that it was going to have a huge financial impact. They said that their ICS had built in a range of schemes, you know, private sector contracts off the back of the ERF scheme. And they said, I quote, that funding had gone down the river. They've not just moved the goalposts, NHS EI have taken the entire pitch. So we've moved on from shifting the goalposts, metaphors into, yeah, taking whole pitches. And that it's not like this is one isolated view.
More reaction would be, well, I'm just wondering how did other people respond to this? It seems like a slightly outrageous move from NHSE.
Sure. Well, yeah, it hasn't gone down too well. NHS providers chief exec Chris Hopson did one of his famous Twitter threads on the issue, and he did say, you know, it was understandable that EI wanted to incentivize more activity, but it's this issue about that all these financial plans were predicated on one set of rules, and then that's been shifted significantly. And we're not talking about a small shift. This 10% increase in activity is a big deal. Likewise, NHS Confederation, James Devine, the director of Confed's acute care network, said ICSs need sufficient support and resource from both government and EI. Any increase in activity thresholds for accessing investment from the ERF will considerably reduce the funding available to symptoms. And coming back to our metaphor of the week, and we were cautioned against shifting the goalposts. So yeah, there's definitely been quite a strong pushback.
Can I ask how many trusts do you think will meet this new deadline? Because many trusts, I think, on my patch were quite optimistic of meeting the 85% by July. But it just strikes me that adding this 10% on at a time where, you know, COVID pressure is going to be even worse than now seems very, very, it's going to be quite hard for many trusts to do. I just wondered how many trusts you think you can see meeting that target.
Yeah, just in terms of it, this for the ERF, it's not a trust target. It's important to emphasise it's a target for integrated care systems. So the idea was to incentivize trusts to work together, and you know, in the whole kind of language of collaboration and not competition. So these are to get money from the fund. It's about ICS is hitting this activity threshold. Do we know how many will be able to meet this new threshold? I don't personally. I mean, speaking to people around the system, they certainly think it's going to be a big struggle. That said, I mean, these thresholds, when they were announced, were not seen as outrageously overly optimistic. They were seen as quite realistic targets, which in NHS target land is quite unusual. Normally, when a load of targets get announced, people go, that's outrageous, we'll never hit them. But when in March, when the initial thresholds came out, the reaction was that this was, you know, a fair ask of the system. But sort of my understanding, trying to rewind back to March, and a lot has happened between now and then, was always that, they could be increased at some point. I think what's been particularly unfair perceived to be unfair about the increase is, firstly, it's been said it's not like it's going up 10%. You've got 3 months to kind of crank up to that level. It's like it's going up 10% from now. That kind of the fact that all these plans have been done on the basis of one set of rules, and now it's changed to a completely different set of rules. I mean, people were talking about just, you know, tearing up their H1 plans. They just said they were completely pointless. So I'm not sure in terms of how widely who will be able to make it and who won't. But yeah, it's going to be a really, across the whole system, it's going to be very tough.
Yeah. How important is the ERF money going to be for systems then? Oh. I mean, what kind of things do you think they're going to be spending it on should they get it, which now looks a bit more unlikely, as we say?
So, yeah, I mean, as we were saying, there's the private sector activity, a lot of the contracts for private sector work would have been based on that sort of classic elective recovery programs involve just doing a lot more work within the in the trust, which means asking staff to do overtime and additional shifts. All that, of course, costs money. So all those kind of things. And then there are also various ICSs involved in what's called the elective accelerator program, which is where they've where basically different areas, and this is a slightly different chunk of money, but worth mentioning, are being allowed to try out different innovative approaches to dealing with the waiting list, because it's generally seen that the kind of traditional approaches of bung a load to the private sector and get a load more extra shifts done within the trust just is not going to be enough to cover what's going on at the moment and cut into, you know, what is an unprecedented backlog.
And James, I wonder how much is politics a factor in this letter and its contents? Because we have a new health secretary. I mean, maybe it's a bit too simplistic, but is this kind of, I don't know, is this him trying to make his mark, trying to speed the NHS up and its path to elective recovery? How significant do you think that is?
Well, things we do know. One, Sajid Javid has been very clear that elective recovery is going to be one of, rightly so, his major priorities. He did an interview in the Sunday Telegraph this weekend, in which he said that the waiting list could hit 13 million. Now it's at just over 5 at the moment. When previous attempts have been made to quantify how much the sort of hidden referrals within the system will translate into patients on the waiting list have been done, people have got things very wrong, and the figures haven't quite added up in the way people thought they would. So I'm not going to have any attempts at second guessing where the waiting list will get to once all the hidden referrals have returned into the system. But 13 million does seem a very worst case scenario kind of figure. And he's clearly used that figure because he wants to make a point about it. And he wants to make a point that, you know, things could get really bad. He's also, you know, as politicians do, turned up and said, oh, look at this massive job that I have to do, that the fault of which doesn't lie with me. And then also we know that Treasury like to make the NHS sing for their supper. They like to get as much out of the NHS as possible. Certainly when I was speaking to people around the system who are familiar with these kind of processes, there seemed to be a lot of suspicion that this move had perhaps been prompted by the Treasury leaning on NHSEI to kind of try and get more bang for the buck for the £1 billion which the Treasury has allocated to the NHS for this scheme.
I wondered, just my last question to you, James, on this, and you might not know the answer, but do you think we could see another U-turn on this, like, fairly soon? Because it just seems so incredibly difficult at the moment. And I know some trusts are really performing really well against the original ERF targets. Quite positive. So
they have been, and that's really worth emphasizing, in that all that's happened over the last few months, and, you know, there's been a lot of focus on year-long breaches, on two-year breaches, on the waiting list getting to unprecedented levels. But the story that gets less focus is how well the NHS has been doing in extremely trying circumstances, about increasing the amount of activity levels that it's been able to do. You're completely right on that. Will there be a U-turn? I mean, never say never, and I don't know, but I feel like it would be hard for the system to turn around and say, oh, actually, it's okay. We're going to take the thresholds back down again now that they've said they're going up. But we've seen a lot of U-turns on a lot of issues over the last year or so. So, I'm afraid I'm going to have to,
anything can happen.
Answer to that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, that's absolutely fine. Well, thanks very much, James. And we'll be following that story very closely over the next few weeks. And yes, as promised, I think now, as alluded to actually a bit earlier by James, but the problems caused by NHS staff having to self-isolate, a story that Matt, you covered for HSJ. But this is sort of a local story, but I think it's really interesting one, is that the implications of it, if broadened out, could be really significant for the NHS and the workforce. So could you just tell listeners just some of the sort of the key points in that story around some changes made to staff isolation?
So firstly, just to recap on some of the context around this, obviously many trusts across the country are experiencing staff shortages just because people are being, you know, pinged, for want of a better term, by the NHS COVID app as being a close contact of a potential COVID sufferer. And they're having to self-isolate and basically stay off work. That is causing real staffing issues. I cover, for example, intensive care, and that has led to, you know, some ICUs being really, really understaffed, and, you know, junior members of staff being really overstretched and actually getting ill themselves because other their colleagues have had to stay at home. So it's an issue, obviously, for the workforce planning, and it's issue, obviously a big issue for patient safety with short staffing. But I think what we need to remember as well is the staff who are left there to pick up the pieces, they're also going through a lot of stress as well. So in a way to alleviate that, there seems to be a way forward which has been emerged in the Northeast, where Public Health England have come out with some clarification of their existing guidance for trusts in the region. And what that has resulted in is that hospital staff who do not have symptoms but have been notified by the COVID app that they are potentially in close proximity to a COVID positive case, now do not need to self-isolate and instead take daily lateral flow tests during their would-be isolation period to avoid self-isolating and to come into work if they test negative every day. And that seems to be a real shift in policy in terms of what other trusts have been able to do and the way their hands have been bound over this issue. And it was, as reported in local media, this is something that Newcastle upon Tyne Foundation Trust are doing, and North Tees and Hartlepool as well, who have come out and said that the apps, interestingly, they've said the apps proximity and venue notifications are advisory only and do not require people to self-isolate and are not mandatory. But they say the text messages and the calls and emails sent by Test and Trace are different. They are, and you know, I think this might signify a way forward with this with this issue nationally. We'll have to wait and see. Obviously, you know, ministers are looking at this issue more broadly. It was announced last week that double vaccinated people won't have to self isolate from the August 16th. So there seems to be a move in this direction to make it easier for hospital staff to come into work in the context of ever rising cases and more notifications from the app. And also worth mentioning that they're reportedly looking at making the app less sensitive, and we can get into the we can get into the logic of that if you like. But you know, the point I'm making is that there seems to be a recognition that this has become a real issue for the NHS. Most clinicians I speak to, health leaders I speak to, are seeing this is among the biggest issues they're facing at the moment. So it'd be interesting to see if this is expanded nationally. But they seem to have come to an arrangement in the Northeast, which is
it is really interesting that Newcastle have just, well, not just Newcastle, but these trusts in the Northeast have sort of forged their own way forward, really, and sort of taken the initiative. I wonder, have you had any kind of, has there been any national reaction to their decision to do this? Has there been any kind of negative reaction, or does it seem okay?
Well, I mean, if you look at the comments we have on our story from obviously healthcare leaders across the country, there are some concerns been raised about whether lateral flow tests are reliable enough, because obviously, you know, the PCR test is seen as the as obviously the most accurate one, and the lateral flow test devices, I think, according to NHS's own guidance, you know, they are less accurate. There are, you know, kind of patient safety issues being raised. One says, I'm not sure I want someone with asymptomatic COVID treating me or my family. So whilst I'm sure some leaders would welcome the fact that their staffing issues might be solved in some small way. There are, you know, there is another side to this, and yeah, there are risks. There are risks in, I suppose, every decision we can make on this. There are risks in just ploughing on with what we're doing now, in terms of, you know, if you get pinged, yourself isolating, and that's it, in terms of patient safety and of staffing. But obviously, you know, if you're reducing the sensitivity of the app, and you're telling people that they are a potential, you know, close contact of a COVID carrier, and they can still come in while using this less reliable form of testing, then that's going to cause risks as well. So it's not, I wouldn't want to give the impression that this is great and it's going to solve all the NHS's staffing problems. Far from it.
Yeah, sure.
There's going to be risks as well.
It just strikes me that they're trying to balance two such difficult things, which is stemming COVID spreading within hospitals, which, I mean, you reported on loads, particularly in the first wave. That was a massive problem. And then also ensuring there aren't workforce shortages. And I think that is a problem now for trust. When, you know, we all speak to people, healthcare leaders, who say this is the thing that keeps them awake at night, is having enough staff. And I think it's, you know, as we know, it only gets more pressurized as we come into winter. But yeah, it does seem like a kind of a brave but quite sensible decision from these trusts in the Northeast. And yeah, it will be really interesting to see if it's taken up by other trusts, or perhaps even if the guidance changed, as you said, there it does seem to be a movement in that direction.
Yeah, we'll obviously we'll cover this very closely, and we'll be reporting if it does become a national policy. It might well be something that they're just trying in one region to see if it works. Although. I mean, we can get into the reasons why, but it's worth pointing out that the Northeast is seeing the most amount of new COVID cases at the moment, according to the latest data, just edge ahead of the Northwest. It seems to be the Northeast is under real pressure at the moment. So this is maybe why this started with the Northeast first, because there's more cases and there's more of acute need to do it, I suppose.
James, did you want to come in there?
I was actually going to just bring the topics onto a kind of parallel area, which is around mask wearing of patients when they come in. So obviously we've spoken a lot about the impacts of COVID on staff, but you've done a piece this week about mask wearing of patients and how that could change after next week.
Absolutely. I think many trusts are saying they're going to continue to enforce the rules that have been in place, PPE rules that have been in place for a long time. They're going to be insisting, some have said, that the members of the public do continue to use masks within their hospitals. We've seen some kind of trusts have put together kind of posters to put up to tell people where we want you to wear a mask. And, you know, other trusts are going further, I think most trusts will be going further. I think they'll be kind of emphasising hand washing, social distancing, trying to kind of flex staff working, so when people can work at home, they do, and just so offices aren't as crowded within hospital estates. Also, I know, for example, Hull is looking at visiting rules, and I'm sure they will not be the only trust looking at this, is really tough. And I think it's deeply unpopular with the public, understandably. And I think that, you know, they're just really worried about, you know, how infections could just get out of control if they change their policies. I do feel for them. I think they're right. Hull said that they expect some difficulty around enforcing this message. I think, and the national message has been very confusing. I think I think someone compared it to when we were told restaurants are open but don't go. It's sort of, you don't have to wear a mask but still wear one. And I think people will think, oh, okay, I don't need to wear one. I think some trusts are anticipating some difficult conversations with members of the public. But I think actually Saffron Caudry from NHS Providers made a good point, which is actually some national guidance here would be quite helpful. because it would sort of back up this decision that trusts are making. And I've not really been able to get much of a clear answer from either, well, not from NHS England and not really from the DH, who've just pointed to existing guidance. But I think that kind of, I think that needs re-emphasising to the public, even in a press briefing, you know, because I think it's going to be tricky to enforce rules. We'll have to see what happens after July the 19th. I'm sort of quite hopeful that people still feel that social responsibility, but uncharted waters, isn't it?
Oh, completely. I mean, we've seen Sadiq Khan come out, we're recording this on Wednesday, come out this morning and say that if you're going on London Transport, then you're going to have to wear a mask. I think it was very brave of these trusts to come out early ahead of any national guidance. But I think, you know, every leader I speak to is so worried about the way things are going to get increasingly more challenging after things open up a bit more. I think it's a bold move, and I think it's a good move. And yeah, it would be really welcome, I think, by a lot of people if some national guidance did come up, just to back them up a bit. I feel like, yeah, local leaders need backing up from their national counterparts on this one.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good note to round off the podcast this week. But thank you so much for joining, and listeners for joining us again. Just a reminder, the podcast is available every week on the HSJ website and across all main podcast channels. That's every Friday. And please don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. We'll be back next week.